Well, as the Sermon on the Mount continues, as Jesus' preaching to the multitude proceeds, he arrives at a topic that, I don't know, somewhat unfamiliar to people like me anyway. But he does continue, as he has in the portions we've been dealing with, he continues to use this rhetorical device of antithesis, contrasting what they had heard with what he, King Jesus, the fulfiller of the law, now will say to them, raising the bar of righteousness, intensifying and applying the kingdom standard not only to outward behavior, but to inward heart attitudes. So turn back to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, I'll read verses 33 through 37. Matthew 5, 33 through 37. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. And anything beyond these is of evil. Now, Jesus' teaching in this case deals with issues that to us 21st century Americans aren't everyday familiar. To make an oath or a vow may be something that we might occasionally do, but it certainly isn't something that we frequently do or something that's altogether familiar in our experience. We often, or we may, lump together oaths and vows into the same general category, treating them kind of like synonyms or interchangeable terms. But if we were going to split them into categories or make distinctions, a vow would be a solemn promise to behave or perform a certain way. And in this case, a solemn promise to God or before God. One spouse makes a vow to the other spouse, a vow of love and faithfulness to the other before God and the church at a wedding, for example. An oath, on the other hand, is similar, but it's to solemnly swear to tell the truth, calling upon God to act as witness to the truthfulness of the statement that's being made. And when we think of oaths, we might think of the oath of office that our new president will make, whoever he or she may be, to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States at the inauguration that's currently scheduled for January of 2017. And I think Jesus' teaching here has to do especially with religious oaths and vows, those special occasion promises made to God and those formal declarations of truth-telling where God is called upon to be witness to a person's honesty and veracity. These were a part of Jewish piety and religious practice, practiced more commonly by them, I would guess, than by us. And what they had heard that the ancients were told was clear and straightforward in verse 33. And that was, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. Do not make false vows, and whatever vows you make, be sure you fulfill them. And Jesus' summary here of what the ancients had, or what they had heard, seemed to come from three texts at least. So we'll just take a quick peek at those. Deuteronomy 23. Deuteronomy 23, Jesus is summarizing what they had heard from the ancients, what they had been told.
word.
You have heard. Don't make false vows. And whatever you vow to do, do fulfill it. And Deuteronomy 23:21-23 says, "When you make vows to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be sin in you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised." Well, vows in this case correspond to the definition I've suggested, that to make a vow is to voluntarily promise to God to act in a particular way or to perform some specific action. And to refrain from making vows appears to be an option as well. And what instructions, though, are given here? In verse 21.
Delay to pay it.
That's right. Don't delay to pay it if you make it. And in verse 23. If you don't make a vow, it's not sin. So refraining from vowing is permissible. And what else? Verse 23 kind of reiterates verse 21. Whatever you promise with your lips, be sure you perform it. And so when you vow, perform promptly and completely. Fairly clear. Check out Numbers 31. Turn back to Numbers 31. For some reason, I did these in reverse order just to make it more frustrating. Numbers 30, verse 2. Says there, "If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." And what's the command here? That's right. The words that proceed out of our mouths, attached to oaths and vows, ought to be done and not violated. Words of promise to God that proceed out of our mouth ought to be performed. One other verse, Leviticus 19. Turn back again. 19, verse 12. We're considering what they had heard concerning oaths and vows, that sort of unfamiliar topic in our life from the Sermon on the Mount. And this is part of what Jesus, I think, was summarizing as well. Leviticus 19, verse 12, "And you shall not swear falsely by my name, so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." What do we learn here about making vows or oaths? Jay?
Don't make false vows.
Why not? What's the particular negative attached?
Because you're going to profane the Lord your God.
That's right. You'll drag God's name into it as well, which is especially bad. Don't swear falsely by the name of the Lord, because your lie profanes the name of the Lord. Your falsehood unhallows His hallowed name. And Jesus, in his summary in the Sermon on the Mount, you can turn back there now, has really given a nice summary with the brief word he has said in verse 33. "You have heard, don't make false vows, and the vows you make, do fulfill." Don't falsify your oaths and vows, and do follow through. Don't drag God's name into the mud of your false swearing, and do all that you promise promptly and completely. And Jesus' hearers, I'm guessing, by and large, may have felt that their vow-keeping and their oath-making was pretty much dialed in. They were doing as the ancients had told them. They were able to say with a straight face and holding up two fingers, "We make no false vows and we do fulfill what we say, Scout's honor." I think they would have been able to say that, I'm guessing. That's what they had heard. But what does Jesus say to them? How could Jesus possibly top what the ancients had told them regarding oaths and vows? Well, I'll read it again. Matthew 5, 34 through 37. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black, but let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. Wow. So Jesus says to them, don't make any oaths at all. By this or by that or by that or by that, and he'll give some reasons why. It appears that Jesus may be about to expose some dirty little secrets about the oaths and vows and religious practice of his hearers. You'll notice that what Jesus says, I don't know, to me is kind of complicated. When we went over the Old Testament passages, we didn't hear anything about swearing by the temple or by the... What does he say here? You shall not swear by heaven or by earth or by Jerusalem or by your head. We didn't hear any of that in the old, what the ancients had told them. It sounds like oath making and vowing had become sort of a complicated business. I don't know about you, but to me, Jesus' intensified and corrective instruction is kind of technical. And that may be one of the points that he's making. Religious promise making and truth telling had become a complicated and technical and tricky thing, so much so, in fact, that what some uttered as an oath was really a disguise for falsehood. It appears to be so. Lies. The religious people had figured out ways to camouflage their lies and in religious oaths and vows, and Jesus calls it evil. Apparently, some in Jesus' audience had refined the art of creating oaths and crafting religious vows that were not exactly false, but they weren't exactly true either. And these were oaths and vows with lots of religious loopholes attached that allowed one to feel like he was being religious and at the same time relieved of any obligation of actually following through and doing what he had promised. So Jesus keeps it simple and says, what? Yeah, let your yes be a yes and your no be a no, and anything beyond that is evil. And we'll get to that in a second. I think the kind of religious vowing that had become popular, maybe Jesus addresses in a later passage, Matthew 29, so you can turn there. I'm speculating a little bit because Jesus doesn't give a detailed explanation, but judging from the way he calls out the Pharisees, the blind guide Pharisees here in Matthew 23, maybe we get a flavor for the kind of mischief. What did I say? Oh, why don't we turn to Matthew 29? Maybe we'll find something profitable there. There is no Matthew 29. I was just checking. Yeah, it was remarkable the way that woke everybody up all simultaneously. I ought to use that trick more often. That was a dandy. Matthew 23, verse 16. Here Jesus does not use kind language, calling them blind guides and fools. We read Matthew 23, verse 16. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. You fools and blind guides, which is more important, the gold or the temple? The temple that sanctified the gold. And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. Here Jesus calls them out for their manner of swearing, whether in an oath or a vow. They had worked out a religious swearing system. I call it the either-or system of swearing. This is my name, not theirs. And they had worked out a religious system of swearing, and it depended on how you worded your promise. A promise that on the surface seemed to obligate them could, at times, be viewed as nothing. And how did that work? How would you have to word your promise or your oath if you had no intention of fulfilling it and wanted to do nothing instead?
Swear by the lesser.
Yeah. In this case, what would the lesser be? How could you make a nothing oath if you swore by the altar rather than the gold of the altar? This would be a nothing, and this would obligate you. Hey, so you could do it either this way, or you could do it this way. You could, what would be another nothing oath if you wanted to? Swear by the temple rather than the offering of the temple. If you swore by the temple, you weren't obligated. But if you swore by the offering on the temple, you were. That was pretty cool. If you could just figure out a way to word your oath, you could make it sound like you had made a religious promise, but you really hadn't. The blind guide Pharisees had refined this system of either-or swearing to keep them from being on the hook, from having to fulfill. And apparently this system had evolved that required the swearer to carefully craft his promise by the lesser thing, the altar rather than the gold, the lesser thing, the temple rather than the offering on the temple. And if he did that, he was not obliged to fulfill the promise. It's like what you did in the third grade when you made a promise that you had no intention of keeping. Don has done this, I can tell from the smile. Don, confess, what did you do in the third grade when you did a promise that you had no intention of fulfilling?
I would profess to be knowledgeable about something and then make another fool of myself.
Well, you need to talk to Charles. You need a lifeline to learn really how to tell lies. Charles, tell him how to really tell a lie. Yeah, you make your promise and then you said, well, it doesn't count because I had my fingers crossed. You never did that in Arizona? Yeah, in Michigan they didn't do that. That's right. I got held back in third grade, so I really learned how to do it right. If you properly worded it and went through the maneuvers, you could create the impression of truthfulness, but call it all off and not oblige yourself if your fingers were crossed. With their either-or system of swearing, the blind guide Pharisees had become like truck drivers. You grab your binoculars and you see them approaching. Yeah, here come the trucks. They've got red crosses on the side. They're approaching and they're bringing Relief! Those trucks with the red cross on a white base. I'm feeling good as they're coming. We're going to open the gates and welcome them in. We're feeling blankets. We see the medicine. I know that their trucks are bringing food. We're all smiles as we open the gate and as they rumble to the curb and park. And then they open up the back of the trucks and it's a bunch of thugs with guns who are going to take us prisoner. They've put something in an outward package that looks friendly and welcoming. We're ready to embrace it. But when it finally shows up, we realize there's nothing but trouble inside. That's what the system had become, apparently. I'm speculating a little bit based upon what Jesus is saying. But the goal in their religion had become, how can I be tricky and crafty to hide my lie, rather than how can I fulfill the vow that I'm making? I'll just put religious markings on my lie and I won't be obligated. And Jesus condemns it. The Pharisees had made a religion out of lying. And Jesus exposes their hypocrisy. Look at what he says in chapter 23, verses 19 through 22. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, he who swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Jesus condemns their either-or system, and he recommends instead a both-and system of swearing. Jesus takes apart their notion that to swear by the lesser temple or the lesser altar rather than the gold or offering excuse them from obligation, because to swear by one is to swear by the other. And more importantly, he reminded them of something greater, a greater reality that ought to have entered into their thinking as they made their oaths and promises that they had ignored by their hair-splitting system. And what greater truth was that? Keep looking, Martin. I like that. It's there. Right. Yeah, him. They had forgotten him. The greater reality that was in on all the promises and vows they had made, both by the temple and by him who dwells in it. He who swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits in it. They had forgotten him in their promises and in their vows and in their oath making. The something greater is the someone greater who is a witness to all our oaths and vows, and it is him who witnesses them and knows whether we mean to keep our word or not. So we go back to Matthew 5. Maybe with a little more appreciation for what was going on there, and reconsider Jesus' instructions in light of the rebuke of their either-or system. Notice he says, make no oath at all by heaven, in verse 34 through 36, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, or by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. His reasons for prohibiting elaborate oaths by heaven, earth, and Jerusalem or heads appears also to have to do with that greater reality of him. The throne of God is heaven. Earth is the footstool of his feet. Jerusalem is his city. we ought not to split hairs over whether we're swearing by something lesser or greater, because God is the great reality that ought to enter into all our promise keeping. And here is Bible math made simple. Some of you are math wonks. But Jesus says what? Let your yes equal yes. Simple math. And let your no equal no. Anything more than this is evil. So it should not be, I'll just put a nod over here, yes is less than yes. That ought not to be. And it ought not to be yes is, what does that sign mean? Approximately equal to yes, no. It ought not to be yes is equal to no. That ought not to be. There ought to be an absolute value to the yeses and nos that we make. Isn't this fun? When you look in the back of your math book, you can get all sorts of ideas. And there ought not to be any fudge factor. How about that? There ought not to be no fudge factor to the oaths and vows we make. Truth-telling ought not to be the null set in our mathematical lives. Yes and no ought not to be imaginary numbers and truth-telling. Okay, Charles, what do you got? Charles must have some math trivia there. Maybe not. Okay.
It's just simply that you found in your algebra book that yes equals yes, no equals no is an identity.
Okay, their identity. Good. And Jesus says, keep it simple. So what is Jesus' point here as he raises the bar of righteousness? Does he mean for us to up our game in the oaths and vows we make? Does he mean for us to make oaths and vows more frequently in our piety, in our religious practice?
No oaths.
Pardon?
No oaths.
No oaths. What? Yeah, he says no oaths at all of the sort that he's making. Yeah, but what's his point? Simply to eliminate oaths.
No.
Okay.
You can make oaths, but make sure that you keep your promise.
Okay. Does his point go beyond that, do you think?
How about you not use God's reputation to substantiate what should be your own integrity?
Okay, don't drag God's name into the mud of your dishonesty, might be another way to put that. Charles? Yeah, I think maybe the lesson goes beyond special occasion religious oaths and vows that you and I rarely make and that the Jews made more than we did. Jesus' lesson for us is in the kingdom. You know, you ought to be a straightforward truth teller across the board. It goes beyond just the religious practice of special occasion oaths and vows that were familiar to the Jews and pretty unfamiliar, I'm guessing, to us. Jesus' lesson here, look, in the kingdom, yes means yes and no means no, with no strings attached. And we're not just talking about the oaths and vows you make on special occasions, but your word in all things. Jesus, I think, is raising the bar on honesty and integrity across the board. They had heard, don't falsify your vows and fulfill them. Keep your promises and follow through. Jesus has no quarrel with that. But he does unearth the bad practice of creating complicated oaths in order to camouflage dishonesty. The point is, be a straightforward truth teller. And when you make a promise, people shouldn't have to wonder, does he really mean it this time, or is it going to be like what happened last time? It ought to be where you give your word and represent yourself as telling the truth. People don't have to wonder whether your fingers are crossed, because anything other than that, Jesus says, is evil. And Bill has noted in verse 32, no, it can't be that, verse 34, Jesus says, make no oath at all. So, if you're called to give testimony at a trial, and the bailiff comes up and says, raise your right hand, do you swear to tell the whole truth? The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Should you say, well, I can't do that as a matter of conscience because Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, make no oath at all? Pardon? Okay, but my question is, should you refuse to take the oath that the bailiff gives you based upon what Jesus says here? I would say no. Jesus is saying, make no oath at all by heaven or by earth or by the throne or by your head for reasons he's describing. He's prohibiting that specific manner of oath making they had made rather than oaths across the board, I think would be an acceptable understanding of that. He's condemning a certain kind of oath making that he describes here rather than all oaths without exception. So if you are called into a court of law, or if you are ever elected president of the United States and it's time to take the oath of office, you could do it with a good conscience. I hope you could do it with a good conscience, but it would be a lawful thing to do it with a good conscience. Jesus isn't prohibiting oath making across the board, but the nasty manner of oath making that had become common and popular. Charles?
And of course, there's another setting for oaths, and that's marital.
Yeah, and you might call those vows, and you could do that as well with a good conscience. Jesus isn't prohibiting any oath or vow we might make, but his point is to be honest in all your speaking and dealing and promising and swearing. Honesty and integrity are required of kingdom citizens whenever they give their word. Tom?
If all the professing Christians in America did that, it threw a lot of attorneys out of work.
Okay. We wouldn't want to do that, would we? So... Sean?
So it makes me think about our financial obligations, like a credit card or even a mortgage, where we sign something promising we're going to repay or pay the funding. But in that case, we have a collateral, something to get back. And in the four examples that Jesus gives, only one of those is something we can control, our own debt. So how does that fit into kind of the financial system of obligations?
If you promise to pay back somebody, you should pay them back.
But it says don't make an oath by your own head. I mean, if it got to that point, you'd be kind of selling yourself into slavery like the Egyptians did for food during the famine. That was kind of their payment or collateral for the promise that they would pay back, right? So we could extend that further. Some people say that, you know, you shouldn't have credit cards because of this.
I don't understand the point they're making. I wouldn't have understood that from this. I don't understand what it means to swear.
Based on something that is collateral that you can control, like your own head in this example.
Okay, well, I've never signed over my head as collateral, and we don't have debtors' prisons. I'm not understanding your question that well, let me answer the question you didn't ask. When you sign a mortgage statement, you should intend to fulfill what you are promising to do. Or the example I'm going to use, I'll use an example here, because I don't understand yours that well exactly, and that's just because I'm not very good at understanding.
Does this prohibit financial obligations such as a mortgage or credit card?
No.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this one is generally just prohibiting a falsehood. I mean, it's prohibiting the idea of making promises and then attaching, you know, the reality is you really can't tell his head because that's what it says. You don't even, can't make a hair white or black. So, you know, what men are doing, they're making promises and then they're attaching, okay, here's my guarantee, you know, and I, you know, to make it look like it's, it has integrity. So the question, you know, the whole issue again is just the idea, listen, if I promise anything, you know, and I put my signature to it or my yes to it, then I will carry out what I promise. And it doesn't prohibit that. I think it's, you know, again, it's going from the whole idea. But I'm trying to throw in some little attachment to make my promise look better, you know, and it really, I think what they're doing in Matthew 23 is they'll swear by the temple, and then they may have sworn by the temple, or they may have sworn by the gold. So somebody tried to hold them to the promise, and they said, well, you said gold, well, you know, it's really the temple. Well, last time you said the temple was gold, you know, all they're doing is just changing. They're just playing games. And so he's saying, no games with your commitments.
When you sign a financial agreement, whether a mortgage or a credit card agreement, your yes should be yes and your no should be no, and you shouldn't misrepresent your intentions. Generally, I think that's the message we can take here. Miguel?
It's more of a question. Is it okay to think and write to say that what Christ is clearly condemning is like speaking where God hasn't spoken and then attaching like a man-made oath to it, and he's simplifying it and saying, well, you know, I would say, you know, if you said, I'll pay you back, then pay him back. Don't say, oh, you know, don't invoke God or the temple or Jerusalem and say, okay, based on this, I'll pay you back. Because now you're saying, you're kind of, you know, putting handcuffs on God and saying, God, you're going to have to do this, you know, because I made this oath and now it's binding. But rather in such a situation, well, you know, just keep your word and just say, I'll pay back according to my word. But an oath, for example, like marriage, well, that's not a man-made oath or a vow. That's something that God has consecrated. It's a covenant. And I think that's why it's right to say, well, you know, we can take that because that's God-given, but other matters that, you know, the religious leaders have just made up so many things, God never spoke or promised, and now we're kind of binding, we're kind of, in a sense, self-righteousness, and I would even say it probably would lead to idolatry, because now, you know, we're kind of creating this God who, like a Santa Claus God, you know, just come to him. I don't know, is that right to say that?
Well, I think the point is, we don't have to imagine every situation. Whatever the situation is, the point is, be a straightforward truth teller. Where you aren't always playing tricks and aren't looking for loopholes and aren't trying to finesse the truth so that you can trick other people. Be straightforward in your truth telling. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, it seems to me that, as you're saying, whatever is the attitude of your heart needs to be the expression of your words. You know, as Christ is going through the Beatitudes, his emphasis seems to constantly be on the heart of the person. And, you know, whether it's in, I shouldn't be thinking these thoughts, I should be thinking of the thoughts of the Lord, and the thoughts of the Lord need to be confessed. And so if I'm thinking in my heart, yes, I'm going to go ahead and do this, and that's what I need to express. If I'm thinking, no, I can't do it, or I shouldn't do it, then I should express it in that.
Good. Yeah, and Jesus is condemning the opposite, which was they didn't intend to fulfill their word, and they thought, well, how can I make it look like I'm telling the truth when I'm not? That's right. The statement of faith has a chapter that you probably never read, and I don't know what chapter it is, but it's actually on oaths and vows. It's the one like you thought, well, how did this get in here? Well, it's in there. I'm just going to summarize a few points that it makes that kind of evolve from what Jesus teaches here. And it says a lawful oath is a part of religious worship wherein the person swearing in truth solemnly calls God to witness what he swears and to judge him according to the truth or falseness thereof. When a person swears, it ought to be in the name of God and then only very reverently not, as the confession says, vainly or rashly. And to swear an oath is warranted by the word in matters of weight and moment, and to confirm truth and to end strife. Maybe a Bible example of swearing an oath is Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23, when he, the apostle, said, "I call God as witness to my soul that to spare you I came no more to Corinth." It's a special occasion, special declaration of calling God to witness. It's allowable for a Christian to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, as a witness in a court of law. Oaths ought to be made only very carefully and not rashly, and only concerning things known to be true, because God is provoked by liars. An oath ought to be taken in the plain and common sense of the words, without equivocation, that's trickiness, or mental reservation. And the confession also clarifies that vows be made to God, vows made to God ought to be faithfully performed, and warns against becoming entangled in vows of a perpetual single life or vows of poverty, which were common in Roman Catholicism and had no scriptural warrant. Well, the example I was going to use, just examples, it's not far-fetched because it's a real-life example, but I'm aware of a Christian college that has a community covenant. A community covenant. And when you are enrolled as a student at that college, you are required to sign the community covenant. And you sign your name there, John Doe, and that means that you promise to abide by the community covenant, which says while you're enrolled at this college, you aren't going to drink alcohol, and you aren't going to do drugs, and you aren't going to dance. Okay? Things like that. Okay? You may Twitter and go, who would think of making things like that? Well, it really happens. All right? Now, I'm given to understand that at this particular college, Christian college, there are many, many, many students who break the covenant. Not by accident, but willingly. Now, if you interviewed those students and said, well, you broke the community covenant, how come? Now, we can argue, well, Christian colleges shouldn't have a community covenant. Okay. You could argue, well, you can't tell them not to drink because that's not in the Bible. Okay, I'm telling you. All right, we can argue that point, but that's not my question. My question is, I go to a student who signed the covenant and who frequently breaks it. I say, how come? What do you think a college student might say at a conservative Christian college to justify breaking the covenant?
I'm old enough.
Okay, I'm old enough. I'm old enough to figure out how I'm supposed to behave. They might say that. Ron, you've worked at a Christian college, not the one I'm naming, but what would the college...
Liberty in Christ.
Okay, good. All right, they'd say, I have liberty in Christ. They'd say, Sean?
I agree with it when I want an admission, but I don't.
Oh, I'm not sure they'd say that, but I might say that to them. John?
I would say they'd only say these are sort of guidelines that you can kind of work your way around.
Okay, they're looking for altar and gold, maybe?
It kind of depends on the kid, but I suppose the state...
Okay. Boy, you didn't say the one I thought. Okay, Darla?
I wasn't on campus.
Okay, I wasn't on campus when I did it. Mary Ellen?
I didn't hurt anybody.
I didn't hurt you. Boy, you're a good American there, aren't you? Well, it didn't hurt anybody. Sure.
I would say, and the other side of the coin, I would say, well, you chose his college, you have to abide by it.
Well, I was coming there, Cherry, but I wanted to hear some more college students first.
There are exceptions.
There are exceptions. Okay, Martin.
I saw the president of the college doing it. So.
Okay, I saw the president of the college doing it. Boy, this is good. I didn't hear anybody say, well, I don't want to be legalistic. All right. You wouldn't All right. But what would Uncle Tim tell him? Uncle Tim would say, look, me and Cherry, you signed a promise. You were a Christian. I don't care whether you're Christian or not. You signed a promise. You're a human being who made a promise. Well, but I didn't want to be legalistic. Well, then go to another college. Well, we shouldn't have a community covenant. Go to another college. Well, a Christian can drink. I saw it in the Bible. Good. Go to another college and drink there. But don't sign a promise that you won't and then break the promise. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. I mean, I know as a college student, you can think of 100 reasons why you violated your promise. But if you sign the promise, keep the promise. Charles?
I'm not a lawyer, but there are others here. This is a conflict.
Okay, good. And you shouldn't have to be a lawyer to figure it out. I mean, even if it's on a napkin, if I say, I promise to do this, all right, and it doesn't even look like a contract, if you promise, do it. If you're not willing to fulfill your promise, then make other arrangements. Go somewhere else. It ought to be straightforward and simple and not complicated. Vlad?
So according to what Jesus was saying, you don't even have to sign. You can just say, yes, I agree to these rules.
Okay, you wouldn't have to sign, but they require you to sign, I'm given to understand, just to formalize. And it's legitimate of them to ask for a signature. It's not unlawful to do that. Again, we can argue about whether colleges should have this. We can argue about whether Christians should drink or not. But Christians should keep their promises in a straightforward way. Tom?
We do the same thing at the mission when we bring them into the mission. And they come to us and guess what, meet. Here's what you agreed to. And some of them say, well, that's pretty legal. That's fine. Go to a different place. You signed this when you came in here.
That's right. Point well taken. Ben?
No, sir.
Okay. Other thoughts? Tom?
I want to mention that in 1 Samuel 1, it mentions where Hannah, in her affliction, asked of the Lord for a son to be given to her, and that she fulfilled
her promise.
Vowed to the Lord.
Yeah. Okay, good example. Good example. And we'll close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you for Christ. We thank you for the King. We thank you for the fulfiller of the law for us. And pray that as He raises the bar and applies it to our heart, that we'll repent of our sin and walk according to what we've learned. Make us straightforward truth tellers and make us people of integrity across the board. And thank you that we get to come to worship now. Pray that you'll energize us and strengthen us, give us grace to do that, and that we would love you more. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.